Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Welcome to another edition of Word in Your Ear. And we are absolutely delighted to be joined by David Mitchell. And David, you are, I think, somewhere in Ireland. Is that right? Where about?
I am indeed, Mark. Yeah.
Hard to tell from the backdrop.
Yeah, that's right. It's by a carefully curated blank wall. I'm in County Cork, West Cork, the bottom left-hand corner, if you know this part of the world at all.
It's
really nice, although it's a bit of a misty day today, but it's a beautiful spot and rather good for writing, and it's got a vibrant music scene as well.
And I should imagine lockdown hasn't really affected you. I mean, most writers who spend, 8 days in front of a laptop at home have not been... Life has been very different during the disturbance. Is that the case with you?
Yes. It's so many things all at once, isn't it? It's both, as you say, it's not a huge difference between how things were and how things are, yet everything has changed as well. Both of those are true, and I'm still sort of processing it. I mean, I move at quite a slow speed anyway, I think, mentally. It'll take me years to really understand what's been happening this year, but maybe I'm not alone in that. It's so unprecedented.
I'm sure you're not alone in that. Yeah.
Well, look, you've got a, your new book, Utopia Avenue, is a major departure from the terrain of The Bone Clocks and Cloud Atlas. You know, it's a book about a fictional rock and roll band in 1967. So first, what attracted you to the idea of why did you want to write about a rock band in the first place? What was the allure?
Well, I know, like you, Mark, and you, David, I've had a lifelong relationship with music. I think most of us do, and it's a fascinating relationship. What is this stuff? How does it work? I mean, you read a book about it, Mark, which I read,
David's,
and I'm afraid
five.
fair play to you both, but how does it work? What is it? How do songs come to occupy this key part? Central part in our consciousness. That how can there be so many things at the same time? They're windows. They're places where we store a part of ourselves. They're mirrors where we see an enhanced version of ourselves. They are just wellsprings of joy, of energy. They are legal drugs. They alter our mental states just by listening to a song. How does that work? So novels are many things, but they're also curiosity satisfaction engines. So I built this one to try to explore these questions.
Do you find also that it's not just songs, is it? It's records.
Yeah.
Because the thing about records that always fascinates me is we got them inside us. You know, we heard them many, many years ago. We've heard them millions of times. We know them better than the people who made them.
Yes.
We're more familiar with them. And that's a unique relationship, isn't it? You don't have that with a book or a movie, do you?
Now you mention it, no. Not as clearly. We have fragments of books and fragments of films that stay with us forever. But actually, an album that we would have bought in the 70s with our hard-earned pocket money that we saved up for and cycled into town to buy from the record shop, and we shopped around to get the one where it was 50p cheaper here than it was anywhere else, then cycled back and then played it. And that was the first play of numerous plays because we didn't have so many. Music wasn't kind of this almost free utility service, which it is now. We internalized every single bar, every single note.
And also telegraphs that particular time in your life so perfectly, doesn't it? Unlike movies and things, it's about a little soundtrack to what you were doing. It transports you back to the person you were when you first bought that record.
The person and the circumstances on that first magic morning when you got home from town on your bike and you put it on your parents' stereo and you played it, and suddenly you play it now and you're back there. You can, it's a time machine. It stores details about the room that you played it, just that the tactile experience of lifting the stylus and just placing it on the vinyl and that sort of noise it makes. You remember it all just from you playing it now, and that's more than half our lifetimes ago. That's most of our lifetimes ago. How does that work? Isn't that amazing? I like what you said about albums, David, in particular. You'd both know more about this than me, but you might agree that Sgt. Pepper's is interesting for all sorts of reasons, but one of them is it maybe heralds the beginning of the album as an art form, not just as a container of songs, as studio tracks, but as a journey, as an art form in its own right, with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and development, rather like a novel. And this also makes the album, say, Astral Weeks, more important than the individual songs, which are still very fine, but the experience of the album is particular and special.
Well, I think in both those cases, Sgt. Pepper and Astral Weeks are both good examples of this. You play them like singles, effectively. Mm. You don't think, I'm going to listen to Madame George, or yeah. I'm going to listen to
Beat. No, you play them in their entirety.
Yeah. And if you particularly take something like Sgt. Pepper, it's really upbeat. It's surprisingly upbeat.
Yeah.
It whips along, you know, even within you, without you. Nothing that you're not looking at your watch at any point in that record, you know.
And if you hear the end of one of those tracks in your mind, you're already playing the beginning of the next one, because the entire sequence is so embedded in you.
I really like that effect. It's true. And I sometimes also think that I need more technical language to describe this, but two artistic units make an invisible third thing because. Yeah. Of the way they are just sequenced next to each other. A fine example is the very end of Within You, Without You. And then the beginning of When I'm 64, it goes from George's Eastern mysticism to Paul's homely clarinet, which might be the opening bar of a sitcom theme. Now that juxtaposition, it somehow makes a third thing.
Doesn't it also have laughter in between? Mark's the expert on the Beatles.
My word. Well, you've out-experted me. Really?
Before the beginning of When I'm 64.
I thought there wasn't the laughter at the end of
There's laughter at the end of the George Harrison. There's laughter at the end of George Harrison, which is absolutely brilliant, which is, I always thought was really sweet, because if you didn't like it at the time, and I must admit I didn't. I was too young to understand what it was about. I found it an imposition. But, you know, you felt that George himself was shrugging at the end and going, I know, you know, just setting himself up and saying, you know, his old character kind of shone through rather than this rather austere and serious naval contemplating sitar player.
It's one of the great gifts of maturity, isn't it? Just to be able to appreciate the within you, without yous of music, of the world. I think the same of The Great Gig in the Sky. It's both are tracks by the band's third creative force, an often overlooked creative force, where they really excelled themselves and made this beautiful, shimmering thing because of the context they were in. And it's great to be old enough to play Within You, Without You and think, you know, you're really, really good and this will be a far lesser album without you.
Well, the thing about the Beatles, you never take away any of the bits. Yeah, people always object to the White Album. They always say, oh, we'd make a better single album and all that sort of stuff. If you took away its excesses. Well, its excesses are as much a part of the Beatles as anything else.
The excesses that you discover later on and really appreciate later on. It's the really simple things that would have made a single that have the initial appeal. You know, I think it's kind of... you know, happiness is a warm gun. You know, I remember finding very difficult when I was a kid. I think it's just the greatest masterpiece now.
It's
the
glorious.
I sit there in a pathetic, rather anal, blokey way trying to work out what the time signatures are. It's just, how did they even play it? I have no idea. It's astonishing.
I feel the same about Helter Skelter off the White Album.
But
what a song. Most of the best music, words fail me when I try to capture it in a net of words. What you were just saying about excesses, David, I sense a recurring theme here that might rear its head again later in the conversation as well, but there's something really novelistic about the White Album. Novels also, they not only forgive, but in some ways I think they even benefit from and rely upon bagginess, upon things where the plot drops, switches pace, slows down, where essentially it's self-indulgent. Now, you have to find the balance. If there's too much of that, the novel becomes unreadable, but not enough of it, then it's somehow like a really well-honed TV screenplay in a textual form. The White Album is a fine example of a it's this schmooshed grab bag of influences, of manifestations, just of stuff. I think many of the best novels, you can say the same about that.
It's interesting with the White Album. It struck me recently in terms of range. Nobody before or since could boast anything like that range. There is no band anywhere or solo artist that can have that kind of range that they had in the White Album. It's absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
The bases they touch there, you know, kind of cod cowboy music, radio light program, late night music, avant-garde electronic music, Chuck Berry knockoffs, you know. It's just extraordinary. There isn't anybody like that. There hasn't been anybody like that since, has there? I don't think so.
I can't think of much that comes close. Radio Silence.
Sorry. I'm trying to stop the conversation.
We'll ponder on that.
It's just a favourite theme of mine.
Classically, another favourite theme is records that you can remember playing in your house when you were growing up. Can you remember the records we were playing? And can you remember the device that they were played on? Because you were born, I think, was it 69?
69, yeah.
Yeah, so in the early 70s, can you remember what was on the record player?
Did a little bit of preparation of this podcast, Mark, and had great fun just sifting through my memories. So first LP that I was aware of was a spin-off of of the kids' TV programme Play School, that he had an album called Bang on a Drum, where the presenters recorded it with a sort of early 70s folk ensemble. And I just had a play of it on YouTube, and it's actually really good. So that's Bang on a Drum. Then first single I bought with my old money, Wild West Hero by ELO. Not Very Mr. Blue Sky, choice. And first LP I asked for a birthday present because I didn't have the resources to acquire it myself would have been ELO's Greatest Hits. So,
right.
How about you, Mark? David, what were your first?
Oh God, my! I always say mine was because, and it's my way of hitting back against people who always choose something kind of edgy and life changing. Mm. They will say, "Oh, it's Sex Pistols, Anarchy in the UK, or it's the Who, Substitute, or whatever." Mine was When You Come to the End of a Lollipop. My Max Vibrate. Now, I wouldn't be telling you that if it weren't true. You know what I mean? I think it's quite interesting that you know, kids grow up with kids' music, generally speaking.
Yeah,
you know, stuff they hear on family favourites or whatever is that kind of thing. But it's interesting you should say ELO because when we've done quite a few of these chats during lockdown, ELO has come up a lot of times.
Enormously.
Really?
Yeah, it is. I think it's that kind of Beatles sensibility and the kind of the pop tunes that appeal to people who are that young, you know.
Yeah.
And there's also probably a kind of lightness of touch and a kind of novelty about it. My first incident was Bernard Cribbins' Hole in the Ground. It's the same thing.
Enough,
same thing.
Enough.
It's kind of like it's nothing cool. You know, that's the first thing I actually bought my own money. ELO, fabulous.
There's an underlying optimism and warmth there that's quite Beatly as well, which makes them, or we might almost just say him, Jeff Lynne, it makes it easily mockable, but it also gives it a longevity because when will the need for optimism, when will the need for that kind of the sense that there's more light and warmth in the universe than there is cold and nastiness. Will that hunger ever go? It won't.
It's really interesting, because if you look at the musicians who get the kind of the most respect and the most awards and the most long newspaper articles written about them, they tend to be the chin-stroking, really serious ones who apparently, you know, who try to convey their inner seriousness. Whereas actually, you know, it's people like ABBA in ELO and Paul McCartney. You know, the happiness is every bit as important to us.
It's never credited.
Plumbing our souls.
Exactly the same as the film industry. How many Oscars are there for comedy actors? You know, but how many for Daniel Day-Lewis doing something searing and challenging? When it's just the way it is. People don't think of the value of happy music. Also, it's harder to write. It's much harder to write a happy song, I think. It's easy to mine the disasters of your own personal life.
It's so easy to fall into the saccharine or superficial swamp. I think when you, I speak as a non-songwriter, but it could be awful really easily. Whereas I think if you're aiming for existential angst, you've got a far greater margin of error.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Because
people forgive
if you get wrong, then you think it's just a part of the kind of, wow, this is kind of bad, but that's the point he's making. Kind of, the universe is a bad place. Whereas, ABBA, I think most of our memories of the 70s, maybe especially if you're male, are revolved around pretending you don't like ABBA, pretending that kind of what's the one the love the da, 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 SOS. It's got that sort of twee baroque info, but my God, it's great. I only need to hear it once a year. That's enough. That's too much sugar, and you start to hear the enamel on your teeth begin to splinter and fly. But my God, it's crucial, isn't it? Just like your blood and your body just sometimes needs that injection of sweetness. I think the same is true for the human soul, and nothing gives you that sugar rush like ABBA.
No, certainly. No, it's funny you say about the 70s that, you know, Mark and I often say that particularly boys, this seems to be a boys thing. Yeah. The boys with music, they use music as a way to position themselves. Yeah. They tend not to tell you their genuine responses to things. They work out whether it's the kind of thing they ought to like, and then they tell you whether they like it or not.
We were working in an office once, and I think you pointed this out, Dave. You noticed that blokes always said, "What's this music that it's playing?" And then if it was something that they felt they should approve of, they go, "I like this."
Yes.
Girls would just say, "This is good.
I like this.
What is it?" They didn't care, you know. That's a major fundamental difference.
We bring it upon ourselves because we will also punish misdemeanors. We will, we form the taste police that will come down really heavy and put the boot in on other boys who like the wrong music. So it's kind of our fault. Like, we have no one but ourselves to blame.
Listen, Mark and I have professionally benefited out of this over a long period of time out of publishing magazines that were mainly bought by men. Men needed to shore up their sense of what they liked.
And needed to argue about it.
You know, needed to argue about it in the way that women very often didn't need to. They just liked it.
It's different. Yeah.
It's true. And on one hand, while I agree with you and denigrate maybe too strong, but kind of roll my eyeballs in a men sort of way. At the same time, wasn't it fun? Wasn't it great? Those conversations. Those. You can't like this because of this, and you can like this because of this, and well, that's rubbish. And well, no, you're rubbish. And no, you're. It's. I loved all of that.
Who were the first bands that you got bothered enough about to go and see?
Okay, I'll tell you mine if you tell me yours, and I know the answers are going to be honest. So I'll start the ball rolling with, drum roll, Bucks Fizz, Malvern Winter Gardens, around 1978. How uncool is that?
Excellent work.
That's very good.
Very good.
I've got another one in reserve, but I'd like one out of each of you before I go.
The genuine first gig was, this is going to sound like I'm making it up. It was Chuck Berry and the Animals, you know.
So, wow.
That was the way it was. At Bradford Alhambra, I think.
Wow. What was that like?
Well, it was like any gig in 1964. It was a package tour where everybody came on and did three numbers, and it was under-amplified, and, you know, it was unsatisfactory in loads of ways, but you were in a place where, oh, my God, that's the Animals, that's the Nashville Teens, that's Carl Perkins, that's Chuck Berry. And then there was another show later on that evening. You know, that's what those shows were like. But tell us, so Bugs Fizz, so 1978, so... That's quite early for Bugs Fizz, isn't it? When did Bugs Fizz?
I wonder if I've misyeared myself there.
It doesn't matter. So,
they were playing the Land of Maple Leaf, so
might be a bit later. Whatever.
In my head,
if
we weren't probably early 80s, but it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't matter at all. We're not
it's the Malvern Winter Guard.
It was the Malvern Winter Guard. Yeah. I apologise for the misdial on my TARDIS there. The next big one, and you're being very quiet here, Mark, so a couple from you in a moment, please. But then Marillion at Gloucester.
Yeah.
It was a nightclub on the script for a Jester's Tear tour.
Yes.
I'm going to correct myself. It must have been the Fugazi tour because they played an early track from the one after that was the hit, Akali. So it's odd I'm ramping things a little bit earlier than they were. I think we need to add about 3 years to each of my years here. But that was number two. Mark, over to you. Two early concerts.
The first group I ever saw was the Baron Knights on the back of a truck in a circus when I was about, I don't know, 9 or something like that.
What did they play?
They played an EP actually called Call Up the Groups.
Call Up the Groups, if you really want to know.
It was an impersonation to the Dave Park Clark Five, you know. Boots and blisters. We'd been marching all night long. I can remember it very well. But that was just like, no, the first actual gig was, to my eternal shame, was incredibly pretentious, which was the Soft Machine, supported by the Andy Roberts Band.
Oh, we don't have to be ashamed of anything, I think.
I wish it was something a bit more kind of, you know, it just seems a bit like I was trying really hard. But that was pretty good.
Aren't Soft Machine a fine example of one of those bands that were never in, so they've never actually, so they can never be out.
That's true. They were also, on the verge of coming in, and they never did at all.
Yeah, that's true. So no one's got fed up with
you. You liked Marillion when Fish was the lead singer and so forth. Okay, very good.
That's good. So more teenage things from you. So late teenage. What would have been preoccupying you?
I was a prog rock kid, and as David said, you find you sort of find a tribal affiliation as a teenager when you're wondering who am I and what am I. You find answers to these questions in music, I think. So Rush, in a word, Rush would be the band that time has been kindest to. I think Moving Pictures now is still, it's a beautiful piece of work. And they made it okay to be bookish. They made it okay to have a relatively high register vocabulary. I think maybe for a future novelist as well, the third time I've mentioned my profession here, but those prog rock albums were attempts at making novels in song. Look at Yes, shall we say it, Tales of the Topographic Oceans. I didn't really know what they were about, but I was drawn to the flow and to the
complexity
like they were endlessly reinterpretable. I'm still wondering what they were about all these years later, to be honest. But the musicianship as well. Bill Bruford, isn't it?
Bill Bruford, the drummer. Was he still there at Top of Graphic Oceans?
Or was it Alan White?
Alan White joined later.
It was Bill Bruford, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Steve Howe,
Steve Howe, guitarist. Chris Squire,
Rick Wakeman.
Yeah,
no,
might have left by then. Patrick Moran's
gone
probably.
He's gone. Yeah. And John Anderson.
John Anderson.
Here we
course.
Are. We're going through the lineup. Yes.
We can do this.
We can do that. We're among friends.
It's
all
safe
right.
Space. You're allowed to say that. We do.
We used to do that at school. We used to test each other. All right, from left to right, Wishbone Ash. You know.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. And how very dull it must have been.
Canned heat with their diminutives. That's what we all.
Yes.
Late teenage years, I went to California, not literally, but musically. Right. So the Laurel Canyon bands from about 10 years earlier, really. But Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, I loved that Deja Vu album. Right. Still do, actually.
Right.
And the lesser lights of that era was, as well. But it seemed to have an authenticity and an honesty that maybe I wasn't finding in prog rock double album magnum opuses.
Yeah.
How about you two?
Well, they were about kind of, oh, that completely. I mean, it's interesting. Is it a lot of it's timing, this, you know, because my kind of prog thing, my prog era was Yes in the early 70s, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Marks were probably, it was Soft Machine and so forth like that, isn't it, a bit later. But then I was big into kind of Californian, Laurel Canyon singer-songwriters. Mm. Jackson Browne and, you know, Randy Newman and Joni Mitchell and the Eagles and all that stuff. Mm. I loved it. Mm. And of course, what you got out of that music was also, you got a lot of things that people subsequently got from other media, which is you got, you know, a Joni Mitchell record wasn't just a record, it was a diary. It was, this is who I've slept with in the last year, and this is what happened. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And all these people, it fascinates me, you know, Leonard Cohen, Chris Christopherson, James Taylor, Carly Simon, Cat Stevens, all these people, they all had affairs with each other, and they all wrote songs about it. And they all openly wrote songs
and told you,
hide it,
who it was that they were having an affair with.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. That's so true. On Joni Mitchell's Lady of the Canyon, there's actually three guys there. There's Nash.
There's Graham
David
Nash.
Crosby. David Crosby.
Leonard Cohen, the priest.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are we out geeking each other here? I think we might be.
I think you'll probably find there's more of them. You know. And
I think it's probably a James song there too, isn't it?
That was the year when at the end of the year, so it's 1970, isn't it?
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Rolling Stone magazine elected her Old Lady of the Year.
Oh, my Lord.
Never forgotten or forgiven. And I'm not surprised. But it's a very different time.
It was meant both as a congratulation and as a tremendous criticism simultaneously. Very, very odd.
Yeah.
But there's something about America. I've always thought that I went through a stage of buying into the whole concept of American culture to the expense of English culture completely. I listened to any dreadful rock and roll band from America. You know, I'd literally go to any last vestige of the Marshall Tucker Band or the, you know, New Riders of the Purple Sage, whatever, while ignoring things that were going on my own doorstep, while ignoring David Bowie, you know, which is absolutely ridiculous. That's snobbery. I just thought America is better. I don't know why.
There were different times. And it's strange to think of it now when we go to the States and we just see the crumbling infrastructure. But there was a time when America was the future. America and the future were virtual synonyms of each other. But things change, don't they?
No, I was going to say, give us some idea of stuff that you've listened to this century. So what's anything that's made a huge impact?
First decade of the century, I had two small people to look after at home. So not a lot. I didn't go out much, didn't go to many gigs. I think went to no gigs for years, really. And I got stuck in that middle age thing slightly, where you stop exploring new music and you start turning into your dad and thinking, well, yeah, this music that the kids are putting out these days, it isn't as good as it was in my day. You actually turn into your dad like that. Happily, however, I was conscious of that and tried to remedy it through things like Late Junction. It's a great program on Radio 3.
Robert Sandler was the presenter back then, wasn't he? Yeah.
My Late Junction. No, two female presenters.
Yeah, I can't think of them.
And the names would come back 3 seconds after we finish this interview. Yeah. And I'd be kicking myself. But that was really helpful. And then in more recent, just in the a decade just gone, it's really annoying that the English language doesn't give you a word for the first two decades of the centuries. So you have to say kind of the noughties or the 2010s or something. Yeah, it's sort of really annoying. In any other language on earth, you can say it.
If only there was a war, we'd have to
flounder around and kind of give an explaining code. But in that decade just gone, the 2010s, my daughter's been really helpful in plugging me into what's happening in the world and some other friends as well. But I think for the first time in my life, I got the point of EDM, that it's music for the body and not for the brain. It's indirectly for the brain as well, but the point is, I just understood it for the first time. Wow, this is 20 years old, and I spent two decades just not knowing what it was about. A similar thing for rap.
Just give us an example of the EDM you're talking about. Which act are you listening to?
Do you know Stavros?
STVROZ. I don't actually know.
Just after this interview, they've got a song, I think it's called The Finishing, and it's about an 8-minute thing with a EDM background and the most sublime saxophone solo for the whole thing. It's got no lyrics. It's just astonishing. It's like, where did you come from, really? And this sort of joy. It's the sort of the first time I've felt it since my 20s, hearing this great new thing for the first time. Music can do that as well. I'd forgotten it can have this endocrinological effect on you. It can kind of tweak hormones out of the parts of your body that emit hormones or adrenaline. Dopamine. It somehow these sound waves moving through the air, it affects your body. More recent decades, Bon Iver. He's a bit of a chin stroking act, I know, but that second album of his, the self titled one, would you know that at all? Bon Iver.
I know him, but I don't know him well enough to know what the records are called. But
that's something else that's happened, isn't it? The way music has vociperated, it's kind of splintered into many, many zones. When we were kids, you could know the contents of every record shop in the country, because it was the same. There weren't so many bands. Those days are so long gone now.
Absolutely gone. People say to me, "Do you know what's going on?" I say, "Nobody knows what's going on. There's too much going on for any one person to possibly keep track of it. It's so various nowadays. Whereas it used to be just defined, as you say, by the stuff that they had in the record shop, the stuff they had room for, kind of, you know." To manufacture and distribute,
and that nobody cares, you know, about the chronological sequence of things at all. You know, my own kids, I can remember my kids asked me which came first, Nirvana or The Doors, you know, this being the American Nirvana, you know, and I think, really? How do they not know that? But it doesn't matter, it simply doesn't matter, whatever sequence they discover them in.
Of course, for our kids, the 80s are what the 40s are to us. Long ago zone, and kind of. Who cares which came first?
I was there, you know, the Q magazine closed this week. Comment, and, you know, I said, well, it's 34 years. And if you'd gone 34 years back from 1986, you would have been in the reign of King George VI.
Whoa.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
It's astonishing. It gives you an idea of, you know, whereas we tend to think the era of pop music is kind of all one thing.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
Loads of different things, you know, in loads of different ways.
Just one particular question about the era of pop music. Going back to the book just for a second, why did you pick on 1967 as the year to place your fictional band in? What was it about that particular time?
It's an open goal, Mark. I just couldn't resist it. It's almost, why wouldn't you? There's the symbiosis of the counterculture and music, the way one informed the other. One was a message board for the other. One was an exhibition space for the other. Just that interface between music and happening culture was membrane thin. Maybe it wasn't even there. Maybe they were interchangeable. And we read how something would happen in California and Buffalo Springfield would write a song that night, and it would be in the charts a week and a half later. That was attractive. Also, the way something about that magic window of about 18 months, maybe inspired by the Beatles, but you get three star acts suddenly producing four star albums with five star passages in them. It's as if Sergeant Pepper's, and I know Roger Waters is on record as having said this, some radio station got a hold of the whole album, played it uninterruptedly. Pink Floyd were driving along in their van. They stopped, listened to it, and Roger Waters' response was, "The bastards."
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, it's the one thing you forget is that musicians are so competitive. Why wouldn't you be? You have to be.
Yeah, yeah.
You just think, why didn't I think of that? Or I'm ruined, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that competition can be a powerful and benign creative force. And it was just a magic harvest, I think, that lasted about 18 months, where you get these stunning records from acts that never achieved those heights again.
And also the time when people actually thought that music was genuinely going to change the world, and everything was possible, and everything happens in fact. In your book, you know, the group kind of meet and they play a couple of gigs and they get signed and they're on a television program fairly soon, and then they're touring America. And that did actually happen at that stage. Things that happened at that speed. Really exciting.
Yeah, yeah. And it didn't last long, which closed the window in which I could kind of have that plausibly happen to a band. If it was 4 years later, if I set the book in the early 70s, then the trajectory could not have been plausibly that quick.
Well, I think also in the early 70s they started to be aware that they had careers and that they lasted. Whereas in 1967, nobody thought 1968 was going to happen, let alone 1970.
You know, there's the famous clip about the Beatles being asked just this very thing. So what will you be doing when it's all over? And Ringo mumbles something quite seriously about, well, I thought it could be useful to... Might be an idea to own a chain of ladies' hairdressers.
Yeah, it's right. Two, actually. He says two, doesn't he? Two.
Oh, two. Yeah, two.
Because Maureen, his girlfriend, wife, was a hairdresser. So he was, you know, the way he looked at it was the way that footballers in those days looked.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll have a career playing for Arsenal or Spurs, and then I'll open a sports shop or a pub.
Yeah.
And my local, my celebrity will be worth something locally.
Yeah,
you know, that Ringo Starr's hairdressers in Liverpool would do quite well. What nobody ever dreamed of was the extent of it. You know, that Ringo Starr he'd been 80 recently, has he?
He was.
Ill. He's more famous now than he was then. Arguably.
It's amazing, isn't it?
that's right, to more people. That's true. More people.
Yes, more people. Yeah.
I know.
All the kids, you know.
And a fine example of how the future is truly unforeseeable. If you can see it accurately, it's probably not the future.
No, absolutely.
And predictions and prophecies, it's a complete mug's game. It's essentially random. Unless you're David Bowie talking to Jeremy Paxman in about 1999, describing what the internet is doing to the world in 2020, which just makes me think he must have come from the future.
He didn't did get it all right, though.
In 1999, he was predicting the effect of the internet.
Well,
in a part of my so-called research for this book, I, of course, legitimize what I do anyway, which is to spend hours of my life trawling the murkier recesses of YouTube for interviews between musicians I like or even musicians I don't like. Just YouTube, David Bowie, Jeremy Paxman, and it comes up, and a rather skeptical Paxman is saying, but it's just another sort of phase, isn't it? It's just a new means of delivery. And Bowie intimates about how we haven't seen even the tip of the iceberg yet. And
Paxman will never catch on. No.
Paxman is his tweediest. That would really bring out the old gentleman's club in Paxman, wouldn't it? You know.
To be fair, he wasn't saying anything that most of the rest of the London intelligentsia within the media wasn't saying then either. It isn't really a story about Paxman's tweediness. It's much more about Bowie's sort of, how did you know that?
We need to know, as we always now traditionally ask people in these events, about your recommendation for the greatest record ever made. So have you singled out one that you would suggest that everyone should hear?
It is, sir, as you know, an impossible question, because there are only greatest albums. There isn't a greatest album, but it is a game. It would be churlish of me as a guest on your podcast to not play the game. So I will play it, and I will nominate Dark Side of the Moon.
Wow, that's very good. That's just because it's one of those things that you have gone back and played, you know, relentlessly and never got tired of. And
it's an
unusual
choice,
actually, because I suppose it is because I suppose it's so obviously a really likable, important record, you know, world changing record. But really, really honest of you to go for it.
The question is really a test of the criteria that your various guests use in order to choose, I think. So my criteria were replayability. Hundreds of times I must have listened to it. And maybe a certain monolithic nature in terms of its importance to the musical landscape since. It casts a very, very long shadow that has... And its influences, I think, have been as far-reaching as the famous first Velvet Underground one with Banana on the front, which is famous for having, I don't know who was it who said it, only sold about 300, but every single one of those 300...
Formed a band. That's right, yes.
I suspect that if you could somehow trace the number of bands that were born as a result of Dark Side of the Moon, then it might be a comparable number.
I think it's an interesting record, an interesting choice, actually, in the sense that I think it's obviously a very influential record because it was designed, either consciously or not, as an experience. That you listen to it like you watch a film, pretty much.
Mm.
You know, that it starts with a heartbeat, doesn't it? You know,
yeah.
It has all those techniques. It fades out with the voices going, you know, there is no dark side of the moon, they're all dark, all that kind of thing. They're very kind of filmic techniques, aren't they? And again, it was kind of, nobody ever said, I'm going to put on
Dark Side of the Moon,
I'm going to play clips or whatever it was.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You sat down, you played the 45 whole minutes, absolute silence. Yeah.
Yeah, you could never chat. You know, I can remember the days, you know, I used to go to my mate's place in Finsbury Park on Saturday evening. And Saturday evening, you know, entertainment in 1973 would be a bottle of cider or a bottle of Hirondelle, nasty Spanish wine.
Oh, you sophisticate you.
Absolutely. And we'd lay back on a strip, on a scatter cushion, and listen to Dark Side of the Moon and smoke. and nobody would talk. And at the end, people would go, amazing.
We were doing exactly the same 16 years later at the University
with Russia,
of Kent.
Whatever, probably. That's right,
No, but with Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, with Dark Side of the Moon, of course.
Yeah. So maybe this is another criterion. How does it sound now? It still sounds brilliant. It hasn't really aged.
I'm not sure there was ever really a discussion about it. You just all agreed that it was great and went on to something else. You know?
But isn't that music? It's fundamentally indescribable. Otherwise, it wouldn't be music. It would just be words. It's proof of the pudding of the variously attributed aphorism that writing about music is like dancing about architecture. So is talking about music. Yeah. Now, it's enormous fun, and I love doing this, what we've been doing for the last, blimey, 49 minutes. But you never reach the end because it's music. If it was a book, maybe you could reach the end. But it has no end. The music's there, and it's not made of the same stuff that a text or even a conversation is made of. It's one medium trying to describe or capture or enter the essence of the soul of another medium. And I love that.
Well, you've made a great success of it in the book, Utopia Avenue. Thank you. It's fantastic. And we hardly need to congratulate you because you've already been a Sunday Times number one bestseller, I believe.
Oh, well.
So, fantastic.
Well, thank you very much.
Been an absolute joy to talk to you.
And, well, same here, Mark.
Thank you so much for
David,
all that.
I hope we can do it again one day.
That would be fun.
It'd be really good fun. Lovely to see you.
Same here. Goodbye. The best of luck to you.
Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.